From national news in D.C. to behind-the-scenes coverage of the Nebraska Capitol, this is your Capitol Connection. And now, bringing the Capitol to you, here's your host, Nate Graz.
Judge Amy Coney Barrett is well on her way to becoming Justice Amy Coney Barrett. We'll break down the best and most important moments from this week's Supreme Court confirmation hearings, including what reversing Roe v. Wade would actually do, and an important civics lesson on originalism. We'll discuss these issues and more on this week's Capitol Connection. As always, we are broadcasting from the Nebraska Family Alliance studio in Lincoln, and there's a lot to cover from this week's Senate confirmation hearings for Judge Barrett, President Trump's judicial nominee to replace Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the United States Supreme Court. But far and away, the most important takeaway from these confirmation hearings is that Judge Barrett absolutely shined. It became very clear very early that there was not a question she couldn't answer, and she showed herself to be everything and more that she was advertised to be: intelligent, gracious, well-spoken, high character, and a deep, thorough understanding and appropriate understanding of the law, the Constitution, and the role of justices on the Supreme Court. Of course, this did not stop certain senators from trying to levy any attack they could possibly come up with at Judge Barrett, trying to corner her into saying something that she shouldn't, or to get her to trip up somewhere. But they just couldn't do it, which is why most of the time, most of the speeches and pontificating from senators had nothing to do with Judge Barrett, or frankly, even with the Supreme Court. They tried to make it all about President Trump and about the Affordable Care Act and about abortion. But all of these attacks and lines of questioning, which most of the time weren't really lines of questioning at all, more just speeches, and it felt like most of the time senators were just campaigning. But all they really showed was that Judge Barrett is more than qualified for the job, that she should be confirmed, and there are now new and radical views about what the Supreme Court is and how it should function as one of our three branches of government. And that's really why this is so important, because Judge Barrett holds a originalist judicial philosophy. She believes that judges should interpret and apply the law fairly across the board. They are not to engage in legislating from the bench or in policymaking. That is not their role. It is not a political branch of government. They are not there to make policy or to decide outcomes based on what they desire or what they want the law to be. That's the job of Congress. And that really appeared to be what certain senators didn't like about Judge Barrett, that she wants to actually faithfully fulfill the role of justices on the Supreme Court as intended. And the Democrat senators really struggled to explain why Judge Barrett should not be confirmed to the Supreme Court. All of the arguments that they brought out, suggesting that some political norm or precedent was being broken, were completely untrue. And as Ben Shapiro pointed out in an article for the Daily Signal last week, there have been 19 times where a seat on the Supreme Court became vacant in an election year, and both the presidency and Senate were controlled by the same party, like right now, resulting in 17 judicial confirmations. And as Shapiro goes on to rightfully point out, they fumed that Judge Barrett refused to pledge fealty to their political priorities, and that she stated that the role of the judiciary is not to achieve moral ends, but to enforce the law. And they fumed that Judge Barrett went on to say during the hearings that, quote, courts are not designed to solve every problem or right every wrong in our public life, that policy decisions and value judgments of government must be made by the political branches, and that she has done her utmost to reach the result required by the law wherever her preferences might be. That's because, in the view of the political left, the court should just be merely another weapon in their political arsenal. Conservatives see the judiciary, as Alexander Hamilton characterized it in Federalist Number 78, as the least dangerous branch, capable of neither force nor will, but merely judgment, an institution whose legitimacy rests on its unwillingness to exercise will instead of judgment. There are those who see the court as some sort of super legislature designed to create policy and decide certain outcomes that align with progressive values, because that's the only way that they could get Roe versus Wade and same-sex marriage, where the court has gone beyond interpreting and appropriately applying the law to creating the law. But that is not what the court is supposed to do, and they know that Judge Barrett knows and believes that that is not what the court is supposed to do, and so they are upset about her nomination, even though they can't make any argument against her or her credentials or credibility. There are no legitimate arguments about why she should not be confirmed, and so that's why there is also this huge push to pack the court and to have the next president, but of course only if their preferred candidate wins, to get to appoint a number of new justices to increase the number of justices on the Supreme Court and to pack the court with more judges who align with their vision and their view of how the Supreme Court should operate and function as another branch of government to achieve their political goals and policy agendas. So that's what this is really about, and what's at stake with this nomination. And that's also why, again, there were so many far-reaching arguments against Judge Barrett in an attempt to derail her nomination. But Senator Josh Hawley, who sits on the Judiciary Committee, he responded and took these arguments head-on, including denouncing the anti-Catholic bigotry that we have seen and the religious discrimination against Judge Barrett. This is part of what Senator Hawley had to say during the confirmation hearings.
You know, we've gotten to read a lot about your family in the last few weeks. We've gotten to read a lot about you in the press, and in particular about your religious beliefs. One attack after another in the liberal media, one hit piece after another, questioning whether you have, I guess, the independence to be a justice on the United States Supreme Court. And it's not just in the newspapers, it's members of this committee, including the Democratic nominee for Vice President of the United States, who has questioned past nominees who have come before this committee about their membership in Catholic fraternal organizations like the Knights of Columbus. And for those watching at home, that's right, you heard me correctly. Senator Harris and others on this committee have repeatedly questioned judicial nominees' fitness for office because of their membership in the Knights of Columbus. When you were last before this committee, Judge, for your initial confirmation hearings, the ranking member referred to your Catholic convictions as dogma that lives loudly within you, picking up the very terminology of anti-Catholic bigotry current in this country a century ago. She wasn't alone. Other senators on this committee last time asked you if you were an Orthodox Catholic. One senator said she worried that you would be a Catholic judge, I guess as opposed to an American judge, as if you can't be both a devout Catholic and a loyal American citizen. This is an attempt to set up a new standard. Actually, it's an attempt to bring back an old standard that the Constitution of the United States explicitly forbids. I'm talking about a religious test for office. Article 6 of the Constitution of the United States says clearly, and I quote, "No religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States." And so when our founders put Article 6 into the Constitution of the United States, they were making a very deliberate choice. This freedom of conscience and religious liberty undergirds all of our other rights because it tells the government that it cannot tell us what to think or who we can assemble with or what we can say. That is what is at stake when we read these stories attacking Judge Barrett for her faith. That is an attempt to bring back the veto power of the powerful over the religious beliefs and sincerely held convictions of the American people. And that is what is at stake in this confirmation hearing. Judge Barrett is a Catholic. We all know that. She's a devout Catholic. Heck, 65 million Americans are Catholics. Are they to be told that they cannot serve in public office? That they are not welcome in the public sphere unless the members of this committee sign off on their religious beliefs? I, for one, do not want to live in such an America. And the Constitution of the United States flatly prohibits it. When you tell somebody that they're too Catholic to be on the bench, when you tell them they're going to be a Catholic judge, not an American judge, that's bigotry. The pattern and practice of bigotry from members of this committee must stop. And I hope when we look back at the confirmation hearings for Judge Amy Barrett, soon I hope to be Justice Amy Barrett, one thing we will say is that was the time, that was the year that the attempt to bring back religious tests for office was finally stopped.
Okay, so Senator Hawley is exactly right here with his comments. And I also hope he is right that we can look back at this year, at this moment, at Judge Barrett's confirmation and say that this is where this type of religious litmus test for office stopped, and that we are not going to see an America where we have to tell Christians and conservatives and people of faith that you can't serve in public office because of your religious beliefs. This was a very important moment, but unsurprisingly, most of the hearings centered largely on abortion and Roe versus Wade. And this is always the case because the Supreme Court in 1973 created the right to privacy and then extended that to cover the right to abortion. And because the Supreme Court stepped outside of their proper role as the judicial branch and chose to legislate and create new rights and interpret the Constitution to say things that it in fact clearly does not say, has created huge problems for the entire country ever since. And so that's why every judicial nomination always centers on Roe versus Wade, because you have those who want to protect that and enshrine it, and those who recognize that that is not, in fact, what the Constitution says, nor was it ever intended to say that, and that was not an appropriate action for the Supreme Court to decide. And so, thankfully, Senator Mike Lee from Utah addressed this very issue and talked about what reversing Roe versus Wade would actually do, the problems that that case has caused for our country, and why the American public needs to understand that whether you like the result of that case or not, even if you think it's a good thing, that when the Supreme Court takes these major decisions out of the hands of the American public, it creates problems for everyone.
It is not the fact that it is simply not the case that the fate of health care in America turns on whether or not someone is confirmed to the Supreme Court of the United States, nor is it a fact to suggest that the availability of an abortion or lack thereof is contingent upon anyone's confirmation to the Supreme Court of the United States. The fact that we have this debate and the fact that it's become as protracted, as personal, as ugly as it has, could, I suspect, be traced to the fact that we've tried to take a debatable matter beyond debate. And we've tried to take it outside the political branches of government, where people can elect their individual representatives and have laws respecting and reflecting the views of their respective communities. We're a country of, 330 million Americans. It's really, really difficult to have those 330 million Americans reflected in 9 members of the Supreme Court. It's still really hard to have them reflected in 100 senators and 435 representatives. That's doable, especially when those people are elected. They stand for election every couple years in the case of the House, every 6 years in the case of the Senate. It doesn't happen that way in the Supreme Court of the United States. So to my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, we're fear-mongering on this, causing people to worry and lose sleep over this, fundraising over this, fundraising over threats that people are going to lose their health care, fundraising over threats that people are going to be dying in the streets because of the lack of availability of this or that medical procedure. I'd ask, have we created a monster? Have we ourselves, through our own inaction, through our own voluntary cessation of authority to a non-legislative, non-political branch, have we created the very set of untenable social circumstances that are causing people to protest outside of a non-political entity? I think we have to ask ourselves that question from time to time. Life is, in fact, valuable. it's not a religious statement to make that observation. In fact, it's the foundation of basically all of our laws, not just in this country, not just in countries with Christian origins, but in basically every country that has ever existed anywhere in the world. A purpose of government is to protect life. That's what it's about. If we can't agree on the fact that it's reasonable that people ought to be able to have some say, at least at some limit, at least at some point beyond the moment when an unborn human can feel and respond to pain, something's wrong with us. And if we're going to leave those things perpetually in the hands of the unelected, it might be really convenient for political fundraising within Congress, but it's not good for the United States of America. It's not good for constitutionally limited government. It's not good for our individual liberties.
Okay, so what Senator Mike Lee is talking about here is really important and something that we need more people to understand, because if you want the Supreme Court to engage in policymaking and legislating from the bench and creating law rather than interpreting the law, then the Supreme Court, depending on who is in power or the way that the court leans, they can either make your wildest dreams come true or your worst nightmare. But that is not how the Supreme Court is supposed to function. And thankfully, one of our own senators from Nebraska, Senator Ben Sasse, who sits on the Judiciary Committee, helped give us a civics lesson, Civic 101, going back to the basics and fundamentals of the Constitution, the role of the Supreme Court, and what originalism means and is all about. And he goes through a series of questions with Judge Barrett, so you'll get to hear her responses here. That is really important and something that frankly we should just play in classrooms, because very clearly a large percentage of our country has drifted really far away and doesn't even understand some of these basic principles of how our country and our branches of government are intended to function. This is part of the exchange that Senator Ben Sasse had with Judge Barrett.
So I think this is a useful place to explain to the American people again what originalism is and why it's a mistake to view it as a Republican position. I think that originalism is a part of a jurisprudential debate. It's not a part of a policy continuum between Republicans and Democrats. I think it's something that is useful for everybody who believes that three branches of government have two that are political and one that is not. So maybe it's useful to just kind of back up and say, when you define yourself as an originalist, what does that mean? And then how is it going to relate to that distinction between the principles that are timeless but the applications that are clearly going to change by circumstance?
Right. So originalism means that you treat the Constitution as law because it commits these texts to writing. And in interpreting that law, you interpret it in accord with the meaning that people would have understood it to have at the time that it was ratified. And the reason that you do that is because otherwise, well, as I said, the law stays the same until it's lawfully changed. Otherwise, judges would be in the Constitutional Convention business of updating the law rather than allowing the people to take control of that. Now, in the case of the Constitution, as I said, with the Fourth Amendment, many of its principles are more general, unreasonable searches and seizures, you know, free speech. Those are things that have to be identified or fleshed out or applied over time. So the fact that there wasn't, you know, the internet or computers or blogs in 1791 doesn't mean that the First Amendment's free speech clause couldn't apply to those things now. It enshrines a principle, and we understand the principle as it was at the time, but then it's capable of being applied to new circumstances.
So when you define yourself as an originalist, what are the other schools of thought that are adjacent to it? And how do you think about the debates among those with other people that are now with you on the Seventh Circuit, for instance?
Sure. Well, Senator Sasse, I think one thing that it's worth pointing out is that in the academy, in any event, where I've spent a large portion of my career, Originalism is not necessarily a conservative idea. There is a whole school of thought, and so originalists are now a very diverse lot. And there is a school of originalism that's more of a progressive originalism and is very committed to keeping the Constitution's meaning, just interpreting text the way all originalists do, to say that it was has the meaning that it had at the time that it was ratified, but they tend to read it at a higher level of generality. So all originalists don't necessarily agree. And in fact, there's an advocacy group called the Constitution Accountability Center, which has routinely filed briefs in the Supreme Court that calls itself, you know, it writes briefs in support of originalism, but taking it from a more progressive standpoint. So I don't think it's, I think probably people think, oh, it's only who are conservatives who are originalists, but actually it's a more widely accepted view than that. I think that if you think about different strains of approaching constitutional text, originalism is one. All judges and justices take account of history and the original meaning. It's just that some weight it differently, whereas originalists would give it dispositive weight when it's discernible. Other approaches to constitutional interpretation may take a more pragmatic view and say in some instances, well, that may have been the historical meaning, but that's an uncomfortable fit for current circumstances, so we will tweak it a little bit to adjust it to fit these circumstances, that situation. Sometimes it's called living constitutionalism, that the Constitution can evolve and change over time. Sometimes it's called like a more pragmatic constitutionalism.
Okay, so I have to pause here. These are really important explanations from Judge Barrett, but you might have seen on the news or in social media that Judge Barrett went through these entire hearings with no notes, nothing. All of the senators, everyone, I mean, they are using binders and pages of notes and reading verbatim, you know, what their staff members put together, and it probably worked days or weeks composing. And Judge Barrett sits here for multiple days, hour after hour after hour of questions about complex legal theories and every issue under the sun. And she handled it all beautifully without referring to any notes throughout the entire process. But we want to end here with how Senator Sass ended his questioning of Judge Barrett by going back to something even more fundamental than what they've been discussing about some of these legal principles, and just going back to the very basics of human decency.
I am nearly out of time, and I think the chairman is gonna take away my slot. So I wanna ask one final thing. Tell us about the Scalia-Ginsburg friendship and the impact that it made on you.
So Justice Scalia, famously, when the vacancy came up, I think it was Justice White's seat that Justice Ginsburg filled. But when the vacancy came open during the Clinton administration, Justice Scalia recommended her, even though they had been together on the D.C. Circuit. That's where they got to know each other. And he knew that she had a different jurisprudential approach. And, you know, a lot has been said in the weeks since Justice Ginsburg died about that friendship, because I think it speaks so well to both of their characters, that despite the fact that they had such great differences and they could fight with the pen, when they were socializing, when they were outside of the opinion writing world, they had respect and affection for one another. And that's how I've tried to live my life with, you know, I have friends who disagree with me vehemently about all kinds of things. But I think that it is dehumanizing if we reduce people to the political or policy differences that we might have with one another.
Might we all live that way, to see every person as an individual made in the image and likeness of God with inherent value, regardless of any political differences or preferences. That's all the time we have for this week. To stay up to date on the latest news impacting family, freedom, and life, and to get great resources to help you, your family, and your church engage with the 2020 election in a Christ-honoring way, visit NebraskaFamilyAlliance.org. I'm your host, Nate Groz, Policy Director for Nebraska Family Alliance, hoping you'll join us again next week. Thanks for listening to your Capital Connection.